Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema. Hello everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale. I am a writer and film critic, and today I'm going to be talking to Jason Israelowitz, who is an attorney and an author. An interesting mix for us, but a perfect mix for the book that he has written, which is called Nothing to Fear, Alfred Hitchcock and the Wrong Men. It is an absolutely fascinating look at the history of several miscarriages of justice and how they have inspired Alfred Hitchcock in his famous movie The Wrong Man, starring Henry Fonda. And it is, I say it's a famous movie, but in some senses it's a little bit of an overlooked movie in Hitchcock's oeuvre, a little bit unfairly, I would argue. And Jason has written a book which will have you looking at it anew. It certainly sent me back for a rewatch. Before you listen to the conversation, I just have to ask you to follow me on social media. I'm at Dr. Jonty, DrJonty. You can find me across Instagram, Threads, and Twitter on that handle. You can like and subscribe to this podcast if you enjoy the episode. You can also review it, give it some visibility. That would be really good. And in the next few weeks, we've got some really big guests coming up, really exciting writers who I'm kind of ticking off the legends that I want to get on the podcast before I collapse in exhaustion after all the film festivals I've been going to. Poor me. I know exactly. You don't have any sympathy, and quite rightly so. Before you do any of that, please enjoy the conversation.
It was really the movie. I've been a cinephile since I was pretty young, and perhaps have some element of the wannabe film critic in me. I always thought that would be one of the great professions, but for a variety of reasons, I wound up going into the law. But I have been particularly interested in Hitchcock, the intersection of sort of Hitchcock's drama and suspense and, you know, entertainment pieces with his treatment of legal issues. That's always been a topic that I found fascinating. And in fact, when I was younger, I did have some ambitions, perhaps, of one day writing a book dealing with that theme somewhat comprehensively, you know, Hitchcock and the law. But I was an associate at a law firm at the time, and the schedule was pretty unforgiving. So I had to sort of scale back my ambitions and wound up writing a law journal piece on Rear Window and sort of some of the themes in Rear Window that deal with the competing values that underlie the Fourth Amendment and sort of search and seizure and crime control and those sorts of ideas. But I always sort of wanted to return to Hitchcock writing about him and analyzing him. And, you know, it was about 5 years ago, I saw The Wrong Man for the first time in many years. And I was really, you know, blown away by how good it is, but also how timely it is for a movie that was made in 1956, and how it really gets at a lot of the issues that the criminal justice system has been struggling with really ever since the movie came out. So that was sort of the immediate inspiration, which was, you know, sort of investigate both the history of the movie and then the true case that it depicts, which itself, as we can talk about, I think is an incredibly resonant story of an innocent family that was nearly destroyed by a miscarriage of justice.
Yeah, I'm really interested that, and now I really want to read the book you're going to write about the Paradigm case and all the other legal centric movies that that Hitchcock has done. Witness for the Prosecution and I Confess, and there's a whole raft of them that you mention in the book. But the point that you make about Hitchcock is one of his pervasive fears was a fear of the police, and that is expressed almost the most explicitly. I mean, you see it in Psycho when, you know, the motorcycle cop is almost like a Terminator 2 Robert Blake cop before, you know, avant the fact. And with this, but with this film, The Wrong Man, it's absolutely about where the basis of that fear is coming from, that an innocent man can just be railroaded.
That's right. And, you know, Hitchcock talked a lot about in interviews about his lifelong fear of the police. I'm sure you've probably heard the anecdote about him being sent to the local police station when he was 4 or 5 years old by his father with a note. And, you know, the story, as Hitchcock recounts it, is the chief reads the note and then puts Hitchcock in a cell for at least a few minutes. Then he lets him out and he says to Hitchcock, "This is what we do to naughty little boys." And, you know, Hitchcock talked about how that experience sort of scarred him and implanted in him this lifelong dread of the police. And, you know, I remember reading his being interviewed about it. He talked about how it was the, you know, the clang of the door that was this potent thing, and the sound and the solidity of the closing of that door and the bolt. He did return to the idea that, you know, to the terror of an innocent person being incarcerated. I mean, Hitchcock would say that he had no idea what his transgression was, you know, for why he was put in there, but that it did give him this dread. And, you know, it's interesting, if you look at a lot of the films before The Wrong Man, this theme of false accusation and the power of the state to incarcerate kept recurring. Even in some of the lighter movies, there was sort of this undercurrent of sort of this sinister association with the police and a real skepticism, I think, of legal institutions and the ability of judges and juries to get to the truth. And so, you know, when this project of The Wrong Man is presented to him by Warner Brothers in 1956, it really tapped into these themes that he had been dealing with for his entire career. And now he could really, you know, hone in on them that much more because it was a true story.
And that feels to me like a departure for Hitchcock, but I might be wrong about this, and by all means correct me, that he's going, you know, he's using a true story and he's kind of using it quite closely compared to how he, you know, with certain divergences, but compared to you know, how he would do more genre-based things like John Buchan novel with 39 Steps and even making remakes of his own films and what have you. Was that association with a true story a relatively rare thing in his filmography?
Yeah, I think it's really a one of a kind for him. I mean, you know, you could go back to Rope and say that Rope was sort of loosely based on the Leopold and Loeb case, but it was really, I think its direct source was a fictionalized, you know, version of that, a play that had been staged. But yeah, this was a story that really spoke to Hitchcock's sort of lifelong obsessions, not only the story of the innocent person being falsely accused, but also the fact that in this case, that person's wife had a mental breakdown, which sort of then pulls in Hitchcock's recurring theme of, you know, sort of female protagonists and psychological duress. And in fact, there was the critic guy, Philip French, talked about how this was kind of an intriguing case of life imitating Hitchcock's art because it brought together these two strands of his filmography. So Hitchcock was very captivated by this idea of finding a true story that had all these dramatic elements, and that, you know, it's pretty clear if you look at the, you know, the archival history of the movie and his correspondence with his screenwriters on the project and his associate producer. He really wanted to present this story without the embellishments that had accompanied his many other, you know, Wrong Man or Wrong Woman films. And I think it's because, in part, because he found the story itself so compelling. You know, this story of a nightclub musician who had never been in trouble his life, suddenly seeing his entire life upended by this false accusation, and then the tragic consequences on his wife. So I think Hitchcock recognized there was this inherent drama and really an inherent terror in the story he was telling. So he didn't really need to fall back on what, you know, we all think of as a Hitchcock trademarks, you know, this the chases, the set pieces, and things of that sort.
Yeah, you made that point quite early on. I remember that this isn't a Hitchcockian film as such, in the sense that, as you say, that idea of tension being built and all the rest of it isn't added to the story. It's just coming from the story. And let's talk about that story. Let's talk about that real story. I mean, first off, what was really interesting is you didn't jump straight into the story of Manny. I'm going to get the name wrong, so you have to help me out. Manny.
Yeah, Balestrero is the way it's pronounced.
Balestrero. Yeah. Okay, I should get that right because it's it's an Italian name. So Manny Balestrero. So he doesn't just jump straight. You don't just jump straight into that. But you give sort of case studies of about five or six other cases of misidentification, which is a really valuable context, because it makes this isn't just sort of some sort of headline grabbing unusual thing. This is a evidence of a systemic problem in law enforcement, right?
That's right. There really had been a series of mistaken identity cases in the 10 to 15 years leading up to this one, where that really called into question some of the basic premises of the legal system that were in place in the United States at the time. And one of those premises was a sense that eyewitnesses were infallible, that, you know, if the police had an eyewitness or multiple eyewitnesses come forward and accuse a defendant of a criminal act, that created such a presumption of guilt that, you know, you just didn't see strong efforts at corroboration necessarily, or the police sort of doing their own independent investigation to confirm the reliability of those eyewitness identifications. And again, there was this sense of, you know, an exalting of eyewitness testimony is really sort of seen as the gold standard. And so, yes, there were a series of cases, and I focus in the book on cases in New York that had come to light, including one of there's a famous case of a stockbroker named Bertram Campbell, who was, had no criminal record whatsoever. He was misidentified by five eyewitnesses as the front man for a forgery gang and wound up going to prison for 3.5 years. Later, he was exonerated. And, you know, even though there were a number of these wrongful convictions that came to light at the time, the legal system was still largely in a state of denial about that issue. That when, you know, the cases got reported, the narrative that was spun out by the authorities was this was a tragedy, but a tragedy sort of beyond our control. That, you know, there were these extraordinary circumstances where the defendant looked unbelievably like the actual culprit, that they were doubles or twins, and that this was a horrific tragedy brought on by sort of sincere eyewitness error. So there were the systemic problems you were talking about in terms of the police not, you know, scrutinizing eyewitness testimony, not using sufficiently safe procedures to elicit those identifications. But rather than see these cases as opportunities to examine the systemic problems, they were sort of swept under the rug. And that left in place sort of the conditions that, you know, Manny Balestrero and his family got caught up in, you know, in 1953.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, by the procedures that you're talking about, you line up it being organized with the accused person being told to wear the clothes of the, you know, I mean, it's literally, well, anybody's going to look a bit like the person who's done a crime if you have to wear the same green sunglasses that the person was wearing who committed the crime, you know.
Exactly. I mean, the suspects were routinely put in incriminating positions like that. And then on top of that, you know, there weren't really strong efforts to fill out the lineup with people of similar appearance. One of the common practices of the day was that the police would put other police officers in the lineup, in some cases with their uniform trousers showing. So the defendant would sort of, or the suspect would sort of stick out as a sore thumb. So yeah, you had the sort of the double problem in the at the time, which was that, you know, you had eyewitnesses being deferred to an extraordinary degree. And then you had the police using these procedures that weren't really designed to test the reliability of their identifications. They were more to kind of check a procedural box and get a rubber stamp put on the identification.
Yeah, we've got the guilty guy. We just need to put them away, and we're not going to test any of those assumptions or any of those.
Right.
We're building a case. One of the lineups included the witness's husband. I remember was a particularly egregious example of that.
That's Manny's case, Manny Ballesteros' case. The chief eyewitness, one of the chief eyewitnesses against him was so scared about the whole process of giving an identification that, you know, she insisted that her husband come down to the station with her. And so, again, often the case, the police were sort of short on being able to fill out the lineup. So what they did was they thought, oh, well, this person's here. It doesn't matter that it's the husband of the eyewitness. We'll just put that person in the lineup. And as you say, I mean, that really adds an element of farce to this type of procedure, because, you know, the idea that the eyewitness is looking at a lineup with her husband in it is farcical.
It seems weird that there wouldn't be some sort of sense within law enforcement of, you know, how can I sleep at night knowing I put an innocent man in jail? But yet, even after these cases have come to light, after the people have been exonerated, they find it very difficult to get any form of meaningful compensation from the authorities, and certainly very little by way of an apology or an idea of reform.
That's right. I think the bottom line was there was not a reckoning by the criminal justice system at multiple levels. Prosecutors who had brought these cases that were later shown to be wrongfully prosecuted, you know, there was not a willingness on their part to go back and unpack the causes, to look back at the actions they had undertaken to see, you know, what went wrong here. Instead, it was more a question of just pointing the finger at the eyewitnesses and saying, look, this sort of comes with the territory. Eyewitnesses are still the best way, you know, we're the best sort of sources of evidence for us, and we'll live with their imperfections. It really wasn't until the modern innocence movement, which would be, you know, it really took hold in the 90s and has become more and more prevalent over the last few decades, that there was finally a recognition that, hey, these aren't these extraordinary one-off coincidences here. These are systemic problems with the criminal justice system that need to be analyzed, that need to be rectified in order to put protections in place to try to reduce the chance of this happening again.
Yeah. I mean, it should be hard to put someone in jail. It shouldn't be easy. You should have to prove it to a great extent. Beyond a reasonable doubt, indeed, to quote a phrase.
Right.
So let's get to Manny's case. And what are the details that behind this particular story?
Yeah, so Manny Ballesteros was a musician at a famous nightclub in Manhattan called the Stork Club, which was, I was only vaguely familiar with it when I undertook to write this book. And that's sort of a fascinating story in and of itself. It was really the epicenter of glitz and glamour in Manhattan at the time, frequented by many different celebrities, including Hitchcock himself, before he came to, you know, tell Manny's story. And, Manny was a pretty modest family man. He lived in Jackson Heights, Queens. He would take the train to commute into Manhattan every night. He had a wife, Rose, that at the time of these events, he had been married to for about 20 years. He had two kids. And as his wife would later observe, you know, Manny is sort of the last person you would ever associate with potential criminality. You know, he was known as sort of this gentle soul. He was very non-confrontational. He was a devout Catholic. You know, Rose would say that he was the personality type where he would, you know, walk five blocks out of his way just to avoid an argument. But he got caught up in a criminal investigation in early 1953 What had happened was there was a two blocks from his house, there was a Prudential Insurance office, and that office had been held up twice in 1952, in July 52 and December 52, each time by the same man who came in, demanded the money from the cash drawer, you know, took about $200 total from the cashier, and then, you know, fled into the crowd surrounding the office. And, you know, the police had never really developed any leads other than they had concluded that this same person, whoever it was responsible for a series of neighborhood robberies of liquor stores and, you know, drug stores and grocery stores and the like. Well, Manny at the time was having a financial difficulty. His wife, Rose, had experienced some dental problems, and the work was going to cost about $325. And the Ballesteros, you know, didn't have the money to pay for it. So that brings Manny into the Prudential Insurance office in January 1953, where he goes to seek a loan against his wife's insurance policy so they can pay for the dental work. And it was during that visit to the insurance office that one of the woman who was waiting on him comes to the conclusion that he's the same man who held up the office on these two prior occasions. She then sort of spreads that belief to other employees in the office, and they all come to this rather instantaneous conclusion that Manny is the holdup man. And so, you know, as soon as Manny leaves the office that day, they contact the police, and that sets in motion, you know, the wheels of the criminal justice system against Manny. And, you know, the police come calling at his home the next night.
And there's really no other evidence except for this, these witnesses. There's no, you know, they don't find a weapon. They don't find, there's nothing in his background, you know, that he's not spending money in some crazy way or anything. Nothing else points at him except for this accusation.
That's correct. Really, the case rested entirely on the eyewitness identifications. Now, the police would tell you, if you had interviewed him at the time, there was one other, what they referred to as evidence, which is that when Manny was down at the station being interrogated, he was asked to provide a handwriting sample. And the reason for that was that during one of the holdups, the holdup man passed a note to the cashier demanding the money in the cash drawer. And that note was left at the crime scene. So the police had that. So they wanted Manny to replicate the holdup note so that they could compare, you know, the handwriting. And so while Manny is down at the station being interrogated, they ask him to write that note five times. You know, they keep dictating the note over and over again. The last time Manny writes the note, he makes a spelling mistake. He drops the ER from the word drawer when he's referring to the cash drawer. It turns out that was the same spelling mistake that the culprit had made. So even though it would later be established that there really was not a convincing similarity between the handwriting samples, the police seize on this error and say, oh, you know, this is further evidence because, you know, you made the same spelling mistake, which really is entirely illogical because Manny, every other time he wrote the note, he spelled the word correctly. So Manny knew how to spell the word drawer, but, you know, he'd been there. This is probably the middle of the night at this point. He'd been there for hours and, you know, he just made a slip in the last version. And yet I think it's an example of something you alluded to earlier, which is, you know, the police weren't really doing a sort of an objective investigation at this point. They were just looking for anything that would fit their preconceived notion that, you know, because of the eyewitness accusations, that Manny was the guilty party.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's and it's interesting how that handwriting, you know, you refer to it a little bit as the DNA of the time, that it's another form of apparently objective but evidence, but a little bit like we're kind of learning slightly with some DNA usage, it can also be it can also be manipulated or used in such a way as to not be quite the slam dunk it originally appears. And the trial, I don't want to go too into it because I think the way you describe the trials and everything, it's kind of worth reading it and enjoying it as a courtroom thriller in itself. Your book is about a courtroom thriller, but it becomes a courtroom thriller. You know, lots of little details hinge on like the behavior of the jury and stuff like that, which was fascinating to see brought to life, let's say.
That's right. The trial took some interesting turns. And again, I think this is an example of one of the other reasons that story appealed Hitchcock, because ultimately, you know, the case ends in a mistrial, and the mistrial occurs because one of the jurors just gets bored and frustrated and decides that, you know, he doesn't want to listen to any more of cross-examination from Manny's defense counsel. And, you know, he stands up and makes the statement, you know, Your Honor, do we have to sit here and listen to all this? And, you know, that brought on a mistrial because it suggested that the juror had a preconceived notion that Manny was guilty and that he wasn't willing to be impartial and listen to all the evidence. And again, I think that element too appealed to Hitchcock, because if you look at some of his earlier films, you know, he clearly was very skeptical about juries and the jury process. And, you know, you alluded to I Confess, the Montgomery Clift movie, which I think is a very fascinating entry in Hitchcock's filmography as well. And there's a, you know, a big courtroom sequence in that film. And, you know, without wanting to spoil it, let's just say that I think Hitchcock presents the jury in a pretty unflattering light. And, you know, I think that and he had done so in earlier films as well. So, again, yet another element of, you know, the true story that taps into these themes that Hitchcock had been kind of grappling with in his work throughout his career.
So when we come down to the making of the film and the and Hitchcock turning this into a Hollywood version, as you might have it. I mean, the first thing, this always, The Wrong Man always strikes me as Hitchcock's real noir. It has a real sort of atmosphere. It's New York. It's about a man trapped. But the other thing that's really interesting is you have Henry Fonda, who, as you say, is a star who comes to the film with Tom Joad from Grapes of Wrath, with a reputation himself. He's already made a whole bunch of films.
That's right. I mean, Fonda and Hitchcock had never worked together until this film. I know that Hitchcock had been trying to get him for Saboteur, actually. It was many years ago, but Fonda was under contract and wasn't available. But I think there's no doubt that when Hitchcock got around to casting for The Wrong Man, Henry Fonda was just a natural choice. I mean, you alluded to his role in The Grapes of Wrath, which was one of a series of these, you know, great social justice movies that Fonda had starred in. You know, he had played sort of the innocent man falsely accused in several different films. You know, there was a movie called Let Us Live and You Only Live Once. He had played, you know, young Abe Lincoln defending innocent men accused of murder. And then, you know, the Oxbow Incident was another the story of mob justice. So I think there was this sense that Fonda was a natural choice, and also that Fonda, you know, projected this basic decency and is someone that, you know, as soon as the audience would see him in a film, there'd be a natural audience identification. And that was important to Hitchcock as well, because one of the animating ideas behind this project for Hitchcock was tell the story of Manny Ballesteros from Manny's perspective. And he when he was talking to reporters at the time about why he wanted to make the film, he noted that there had been other, you know, innocent man films, but they typically didn't center the narrative around the innocent person himself or herself. That instead, you know, you got movies like Call Northside 777, which kind of focuses on a reporter played by Jimmy Stewart working to free the innocent the innocent man who's in prison. Or another one he mentioned was Boomerang, sort of about a prosecutor who realizes that a man who's being set up to take the fall for a murder app is innocent. So Hitchcock very much wanted to tell the story primarily from Manny's perspective, and again, building empathy by casting Fonda sort of dovetailed with that objective. And the other thing that was, I think, fascinating about Fonda for this role is, I mean, Fonda, you know, has a great deal of range, and that, you know, in some of those earlier movies like Grapes of Wrath, you know, you get decency, you get sort of homespun eloquence, but you also get rage, you know, willing defiance, anger. He shows he's sort of capable of violence when the time comes. But again, consistent with the idea that they wanted to be true to the facts of what happened here, Fonda really suppressed that element, and you know, was true to Manny Ballesteros' real personality, which was this very rather unassuming, soft-spoken guy who, you know, throughout the film doesn't make, you know, angry speeches about how he's innocent. And instead, consistent with reality, you just get the sense that, you know, this guy is like a train has run over him. He's just, you know, living his day-to-day existence while he's under siege here through wrongful prosecution is, you know, the most he can do.
Interesting, those earlier films as well, there's always a sense, and I think this is true even today when we get an innocent man sort of film or, you know, miscarriage, that there's a degree of what we would call sort of victim blaming of like, you know, if only you hadn't done this, or if only you didn't drink so much, or if only you didn't, you always have the scene where the lawyer says, if you don't tell me the truth, why didn't you tell me this before? And it's just like, wait a minute. Whereas with this, with Manny, you never really doubt his innocence for a second. There's no sense that he's in the wrong man. I mean, that he's in some way complicit with his own downfall. He is just, as you say, just been hit by a train.
That's right. You know, the interesting thing in the way the narrative spins out, of course, is that even though, as you say, Manny is completely innocent and Rose, his wife, certainly had nothing to do with him being falsely arrested. Rose, in the story and in real life, became consumed with guilt herself that this was somehow her fault because she had been the one who had the dental problems, and it was to try to address those problems that Manny went to the insurance office to get the loan, and that's where he was misidentified. So you have kind of this kind of ironic and sort of disturbing element of the story where, you know, these are truly innocent people, as you say, and yet Rose was beset with this irrational sense of guilt that led to an emotional breakdown.
And that as well was kind of Fonda's key into the role, that he wanted to do the film, not so much because of Manny's innocence, but because his own wife had recently, his estranged wife, mother of Peter and Jane Fonda, had recently committed suicide, had a breakdown. So he saw an opportunity to sort of explore that emotional trauma that he had just been through.
That's right. When he was interviewed later about the film, he said that was one of the elements of Manny's story that he could really relate to, the tragedy that Rose went through and its connection to his estranged wife's death. Frances, I think, was her name. So that was certainly one of the elements that drew Fonda to the project. And I think the other element, and I think this is probably one of the things that drew Fonda to a lot of the social justice films I mentioned, is there was this incident when he was only 14 and living in Omaha, where he had witnessed the horrific lynching of a Black man named Will Brown. The story is a terrible tragedy where Brown was a man who had been falsely accused of the rape of a white woman. He was being held in the courthouse in Omaha. And, you know, the thousands of people descended on the courthouse square demanding that Brown be turned over for vigilante justice, essentially. And when the police refused, they basically overcame the police. They got into the courthouse, they seized Brown, and they murdered him, and they lynched him, and they mutilated him. And Fonda would say that it was really the most horrific thing he had ever seen. And it's clear that that experience, what he witnessed that night, informed any number of the roles that he would later take on. And a number of the films like The Oxbow Incident or Young Mr. Lincoln, or even this film, really come down pretty hard on mob mentality. And, you know, this movie isn't, you know, when people think of this film, they don't think necessarily of mob mentality. But early in the film, there's a scene, the scene that takes place in the insurance office where Manny is first misidentified as the criminal, really does put mob mentality on display in a pretty probing light, because you can see that what happens is one of the first employee there who misidentifies Manny then kind of spreads that belief throughout the office. And you could see the employees sort of working each other into a bit of a frenzy. You know, there's a combination of fear and anxiety and a desire for revenge in that scene. And I think that both Fonda and Hitchcock were very preoccupied with this theme of mob justice. Hitchcock dealt with it a number of times in other films as well. And I think that even though it's in a somewhat more mundane context in an insurance office, it's really on display in the scene when Manny gets misidentified.
Yeah, it's a kind of groupthink, isn't it? And, you know, his Hitchcock's sort of somewhat contemptuous attitude towards juries is based maybe on him thinking, God, you know, by a jury of my peers. No, thank you.
That's exactly right.
One of the other aspects that I think is really interesting about this film in terms of his general filmography is this feels to me probably Hitchcock's most spiritual film. You've got Manny's Catholicism, and you've got, you know, a moment where he breaks down and he's really praying, and that sort of comes at a very important moment in the film. I mean, this is informed by the real life fact that we've already mentioned, but it does feel like something that Hitchcock picks up, which isn't, again, we don't usually think of it as being in Hitchcock's wheelhouse, so to speak.
That's right. And that whole interpretation of the movie is one of the fascinating things that came to light in the research, because I think that's a reading that a number of scholars have taken of this film, that, you know, it's the most Catholic film, and the scene where, you know, Manny is praying sort of gives way to the scene where the real culprit is captured. And, you know, the implication that some have read into that is that, you know, the capture of the real culprit was an answer to a prayer. And when you go back and look at the archival records, again, there was a lot of correspondence exchanged between Hitchcock and the screenwriters while the movie was being made or while it was in its planning phases. And Hitchcock sort of anticipated this reading of the film. He said, and one of the comments about the screenplay's draft, the draft screenplay for this scene, he said, we should clarify in the dialogue that Manny is not praying for deliverance in this scene, that he's praying for strength. And in fact, that's the dialogue was put into the character of Manny's mother, who's in that scene. Manny's mother is the one sort of who beseeches him to pray, but she says, pray for strength, Manny. And Hitchcock in the correspondence specifically says he wanted that change because he doesn't want Manny's exoneration ultimately to be seen as the answer to a prayer. And yet that's really how it's been read. I think that change that was made was just a little too subtle to, you know, forestall reading. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting because it is fair to characterize it as kind of a uniquely religious moment, seemingly religious moment in the film. And yet, you know, again, if we go back to one of Hitchcock's missions in making this film, he kept talking about how he wanted everything to be true to the record of what happened. When the day that the real culprit was caught, Manny went to see Rose, and Manny asked Rose to pray for him and pray for him to be exonerated. And that's in an interview that Manny gave the next day. So there was, even within that kind of spiritual element you're talking about, there was this kind of seed of truth that Hitchcock found in the record.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a really interesting moment. And I think even the pray for strength or pray for, you know, I could see someone believing in a divine intervention saying, ah, well, even there, you would God is rewarding his devotion rather than a specific answering a specific request. What was the effect of this film on the debate and on the process? I mean, you're talking about the Innocent Project not really coming into itself until the 1990s, and that this film's released in 1954, I think.
56.
Sorry, so 1956. That's a long stretch of time. Does this in any way contribute to that movement?
Yeah. The answer would be not really. In fact, you know, the case, neither the case nor the film, were sort of appreciated. I don't think that the significance of either the case or the film were fully appreciated when they, you know, came to light. If we start with the case itself, the narrative, again, that was presented by the authorities when Manny was ultimately exonerated was very similar to those other cases. This was, I mean, look at these. If you look at all, you know, I think I pulled like every article that was ever written about this case, thanks to newspapers.com and, you know, other sources. And time and again, they kept referring to Manny and the real culprit, whose name was Charles Danielle, as doubles or twins, which was not the case. When you look at the pictures side by side, I mean, there's sort of a passing resemblance, but the idea that these men were, you know, identical is really unfounded. And yet that's how the case got reported. And that's how the prosecutors sort of explain this miscarriage of justice to the public. So the reality is that it was just seen as another aberration, you know, an unusual one in a million type of case that did not lead to any introspection or any reform at the time. And then Hitchcock's movie, I think this is an interesting case of how films can be looked at through the lens of sort of the values of their time. You know, Martin Scorsese has talked about how modern audiences can appreciate older films, you know, uninhibited by the values that prevailed at the time the film was made. Well, I think at the time this film came out, there was still a pretty healthy amount of deference to the criminal justice system. There was a general faith in legal institutions and the police. So this movie didn't really land for the most part as a critique of the criminal justice system, even though I think that critique is there. I think it's just that given the norms of the day, you know, the film wasn't really received in the way I think audiences react to it today. I think if you watch it today, in light of everything we know about the number of wrongful convictions that have come to light, the systemic problems with its criminal justice system, you really see that, you know, this is a kind of a classic case of a rush to judgment, a case where, you know, precautions were not taken and where an innocent family was nearly destroyed in a situation that was really within the control of the criminal justice system, as opposed to this idea that this was an unbelievable, unfathomable coincidence that led to an unavoidable tragedy.
Well, I mean, you even use the point, part of a story of someone being arrested and going down to the station to, oh, if you're an innocent man, I mean, it's in the title of your book, you have nothing to fear. If you're innocent, you have nothing to fear. And this guy is fortunate that the witness goes, no, it's not him, and he goes home, and he realizes, my God, there but for the grace of God. But, you know, we shouldn't be organizing legal systems on but for the grace of God. You know, we should be organizing them on, you know, legitimate structures of safety and protocol. The relevance of it today feels incredibly timely, especially given how much we now know about police procedures being revealed by body cams and you know, mobile phone footage and stuff. And I thought it was really interesting as well. One of the characters, one of the case studies you place is that of a guy who's Black, and he's another case of misidentification. And you make the point later on where you say Manny's a family man, he's a Catholic, he's white, he's actually sort of a perfect poster boy for an innocent man gone wrong. Whereas if he was Black, then nobody would have looked twice at this case. I mean, I'm sorry, I don't want to put words into your mouth, but
that's right. I mean, there was the case you allude to. A young man named Thomas Oliver, who was wrongfully convicted of armed robbery and assault, you know, that was, you know, barely registered with the public and barely registered with the criminal justice system at the time, as contrasted with the exoneration of white defendants. I mean, if you compare the case I mentioned earlier, Bertram Campbell, I mean, that case was on the front page of the New York Times and many other New York newspapers time and again over an extended period. Thomas Oliver, a young black man who was served over a year in prison for a crime he did not commit, that was relegated to a couple of paragraphs inside the paper. So, you know, I think it's absolutely correct to say that, you know, on top of all these other systemic problems that went unaddressed at the time with eyewitness over-reliance on eyewitness testimony, procedures that were not in place to protect the innocent, then you have the issue of disparate treatment and racism, and that posed that greater risk to you know defendants like Thomas Oliver. So and again, as you say, Hollywood certainly was much more likely to tell the story of Manny Ballestrero for the reasons you mentioned, because you know you had sort of this idealized, from a Hollywood perspective, what they perceived to be this idealized protagonist.
I was wondering, and it's sort of moving away a little bit from the book, where, as an attorney, as someone who works in the legal system, when you're watching films, do you spend quite a lot of time going, nah, that would not happen? I mean, I guess that legal dramas are very much part of the daily diet of TV more than cinema, but still we have lots of Matthew McConaughey, the Lincoln lawyer, and others. Are there times where it sort of it clicks with you and you go, yes, that's exactly right?
You know, for the most part, I have pretty low expectations when it comes to how realistic a lot of these stories are. I enjoy them. I mean, I go back to, you know, when I was a kid watching the Paul Newman film The Verdict over and over.
Sidney Lumet film, amazing film.
I love that movie. I lost track of how many times I must have seen that when I was younger, which I just loved as a character story. I mean, I love the courtroom theatrics of it, but I don't really, for the most part, come to these films expecting realism. And that is, you know, if we go back to The Wrong Man for a minute, I mean, that's one of the reasons I became fascinated with this film, which is that it does have a very unusual commitment to presenting a criminal defendant's experience in a realistic fashion. And it's very striking. And I think that it's one of the reasons it's so timeless. It's kind of an interesting thing about this film. On the one hand, it's kind of like a time capsule that you get to see what people like Manny were going through in the 1950s. It's also a wonderful time capsule of what New York looked like, because so much of the film was shot on location in Manhattan and Queens and Brooklyn. And yet at the same time, because we know that these issues would plague the system for so many years after, it's still so timely and urgent. And you know, and I think also there's a lot of restraint involved in what Hitchcock was doing here. And I think that may contrast it with a lot of the other legal themed films that Hollywood has made. You know, most Hollywood films go for those, you know, moments of high courtroom drama, you know, the Perry Mason moments, the dramatic cross-examination revelations, the powerful opening and closing statements, all the those moments of high drama, and they make for good entertainment. But I think the reality is more of what this film presents. I mean, you can see in this film, it's not an extended courtroom sequence, but you can see that Frank O'Connor, who is Manny's lawyer, really straining to hold the attention of the jury. It's sort of a slog of a cross-examination, and you get a sense of that even from just a very short snippet of it. Again, Hitchcock, I think he once said that, you know, I think it may have been in connection with the Paranoid case, I'm not sure, but that he found it difficult to film courtroom scenes in a super interesting way. So he set out again to frame the courtroom scenes through Manny's perspective. And again, there's a focus not so much on the lawyering and the testimony, but on sort of Manny's mindset and how Manny is sort of looking around the courtroom sort of horrified that, you know, people aren't paying attention. You know, his life is on the line here. And, you know, you see the prosecutor sharing a joke with his assistant. You even see Manny's sister kind of busily putting on lipstick, and you know, and the brother-in-law isn't really paying attention. And Hitchcock said that, you know, he wanted to present that in a way that that was true to the message that, you know, at this point, Manny really didn't have a friend in the world.
Yeah, that's so interesting. It always reminds me as well, Hitchcock coming from the same city as Dickens as well, that sort of feeling of, of human life, just not concentrating on drama. You know, it's not
right.
Things are happening in the margins, which are more interesting as far as the people there are concerned. It's a brilliant book. It's a really interesting read. It's a really fascinating true story. And I think I'll tell you what it reminded me of as a book, the approach. It reminded me of what Glenn Frankel does with his film books, where he uses the film as well as being intensely interested in the film, but as a way of sort of looking at a whole slice of society. And I hope that sounds like high praise, because it's certainly meant to be, because Glenn's one of the finest writers in the business, I think.
Oh, I appreciate that. And I agree with you about what a great writer Glenn is. And you're right on the money, because when I was thinking about the structure of this book, it is a little unusual in that, you know, the book is sort of divided into the narrative nonfiction of Manny's story, and then sort of the second half of the book focusing on the film. But I did take inspiration for sure from Glenn's books, in particular the book he wrote about the Searchers, which is really, you know, the very first half of the book is devoted to the true story of that inspired the film. So I appreciate the comparison and share your admiration for Glenn's writing, which I think is wonderful.
So do we have are we going to look forward to some more books about the I mean, not, it doesn't have to be the criminal justice system and cinema, but more cinema books from you?
I hope so. This one took a long time. It took about 5 years, and you know, I was pretty much a full-time lawyer, meaning that, you know, this really had to get done on the weekends. So to say that I was moving at a bit of a snail's pace at times is probably an understatement. But I certainly would love to do another project like this. I love the movies, but I also in particular love movies that shed light on the, you know, kind of the legal and cultural issues of their day. And I think it's sort of a fascinating way to engage with history and to engage with social and political issues.
So, right. So we're basically down to the last question, which is the question I ask everybody on the podcast. You'll know from listening to the podcast. What film book would you recommend our listeners pick out, look out for?
Well, I know you have a tradition of guests cheating this question a bit by picking more than one. So I may continue that tradition, if that's okay.
That's fine.
But one of the best I've read is Matt Zoller Seitz's Oliver Stone book, which is called The Oliver Stone Experience.
Ah.
And what I love about that book is it kind of cuts across different types of film books. I mean, I think Matt is one of the great critics. And so you get in the book many of great insights about Stone's work. But at the same time, you know, much of the book consists of Matt's interviews with Stone, you know, like a transcript of them. And so you kind of get a critical perspective on the Stone films, and you get Stone's own perspective all at once. And in that sense, when I read that book, it very much for me evoked the Truffaut book about Hitchcock, you know, where it's sort of an extended discussion between Hitchcock and Truffaut about Hitchcock's career. And, you know, there are a lot of very animated and revealing exchanges between Matt and Stone. And then there are also other wonderful things in the book, the photos, the storyboards, script excerpts. And so and then on top of that, it's just a beautiful book. It's massive. But so I highly recommend that one. I guess my other pick is somewhat infused with nostalgia for me, because when I was growing up, the great film critic Roger Ebert was releasing on an annual basis these kind of compendiums or annual collections of the reviews he published, excuse me, in the Chicago Sun-Times. And I was sort of a budding cinephile at the time. And that those collections of reviews were just a great way to engage with the movies. And I don't know if those are the annual editions are still in print, but I do know that he at some point collected his reviews in multiple volumes called The Great Movies, like The Great Movies, Volume 1, Volume 2. And I just found Ebert's writing so accessible and crisp. And again, as with Matt's writing, you get a lot of great insights in the film, but you also get a lot of beautiful writing as well. And I just learned a lot about movies and about writing from those Roger Ebert books. So I would encourage anyone who wants to kind of see what great criticism is to read those Roger Ebert reviews.
Yeah, absolutely. I had the pleasure of meeting Chaz Ebert at Cannes this year, and it was great to, by one remove, have sit down and talk to someone about the great man himself. And that was a lovely experience. Yeah, I think we all have those critics. I mean, I think my first one was probably Dilys Powell, who was a Sunday Times critic, the London Sunday Times. And She just was, you know, she was the one that I was reading every week, every Sunday, and I would pay real attention to her recommendation. I was going to go and see any film, whatever film I could see anyway. It was like a case of distinguishing, but I just wanted to see how my opinion stood up against hers.
Yeah, and the great critics like that, it's a pleasure to read, even if you don't agree with their perspective on a given film, you can still get so much out of it. You know, one of the things that's somewhat, one of the many disturbing things about, you know, the closure of a lot of American newspapers is, you know, just the bench of regular film critics has been, you know, gradually diminishing. I mean, there were so many more film critics when I was growing up as compared to now.
Yeah, you used to have this cross-fertilization and these arguments going on, and Andrew Saris here and, you know, Pauline Kael over there. And yeah, it does feel like that. But I also think, I mean, I like that thing about disagreeing with someone. I often disagree with Richard Brody, but I love his writing. I'll read him any day of the week.
Exactly right. I mean, you know, the great critics. I mean, another one that jumps out to me, I love Manola Dargis in the New York Times. Mm. And, you know, her reviews, just like A.O. Scott, who no longer is writing for the Times, but their reviews are just like these essays, beautifully written essays about the movie. It's just a way of getting such an informed and expert perspective and seeing things in these movies that, you know, may not have dawned on you when you first saw them.
All about enriching the culture. And by golly, we need the culture to be enriched.
That's right.
Well, listen, Jason, it's been absolutely great fun talking to you. And it's a wonderful book. I really recommend it. I'll put a link in the show notes. It's from an independent publisher, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct.
Yep. So I'll put a link so that people can go and get it, and they should do. And I'm looking forward to reading your next work. Hopefully it won't take so long for you.
Thanks so much for the kind words, John. I really appreciate it. And I love your podcast. So thank you for doing this.
So that was me and Jason and our conversation. I hope you enjoyed it. I mean, it's amazing talking to a guy who has such a depth of knowledge about so many things that I don't know about, but I'm so interested in. So that was a great informative conversation. I hope you enjoyed it too. All that's left for me is to thank Elliot Atkins for the music, Ali Harwood for the artwork, and to thank you, dear listener, for sticking with us. Take care. Thank you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.